No, now welcome. Welcome. Welcome to the nose. I have to turn up this thing. You see, you're getting a little fourth wall stuff here right now. So we're down in the our beautiful studios in Gateway, beautiful community, beautiful college in beautiful New Haven. And I don't really know how anything works here. And I don't really have to operate very many things, and I'm still stymied. So, but anyway, it's good to be here in New Haven. I took the train down from Hartford. Do take the train. It's such a nice thing.
I took the train from the airport, and getting to the train was hard. But
right.
But
well,
the ride was great.
Yeah, and it's just so great. And I get off at State Street, and I walk over here, and it's great. So some of the voices you already heard are our guests on the nose today. That was Pedro Soto, an account executive at DRT Power Systems in New Haven. Tom Breen is a film critic, reporter for the New Haven Independent, and host of WNHH Radio's film program, Deep Focus. Mercy Quay is founder and executive director of The Narrative Project. Would you like me to start saying The Narrative Project in a specific voice the way I do for Tom?
Well, no, but work it out for sure.
Right.
You remember the
snaps. Oh, right, I have to work it out.
Yeah, work it out.
Oh, but that's not even in
here. It's not on there, no.
Yeah. So you still do a program called Work It Out?
I do.
I'm so white when I do the Work It Out thing, though. Like, I have a... She's laughing because she thinks I'm so white 100% of the time, not just when I'm saying a particular thing and trying to snap my fingers the way she wants me to. But
explaining my laughter is like my favorite thing.
Well, your mouth is a percussive instrument. You told us that. So that should be contextualized. You were beatboxing here in the studio.
And my fiance thinks that my mouth is a percussive instrument.
Because you make noise when you eat.
When I eat, yeah. Yeah. I do, because things are so delicious.
I didn't want you to think that I just said something weird like that to Mercy Quay. All right, so later in the show, speaking of weird, we'll be talking about Sharp Objects. This is an HBO offering. It comes from Gillian Flynn, she of Gone Girl and other things. It is made by the director of Big Little Lies and Wild and Dallas Buyers Club. And it stars Amy Adams, ably assisted by Patricia Clarkson. So we'll be coming to that. It's set in Wind Gap, Missouri, which apparently is the day drinking capital of America, and many other things beside. But we'll come to that. Before we get to that, we're going to talk about two things here in the first segment. One of them is sort of the latest round of people in the media having to explain things that they said or tweeted or did a long time ago, and in particular, James Gunn, director of Guardians of the Galaxy, and Sarah Silverman. Surprise, surprise, Sarah Silverman has said outrageous things in the past. Anyway, we'll explain all that to you, but first we have to begin with Ariana Grande. Ariana Grande, we're just going to sort of assume that you kind of know who Ariana Grande is.
Well, don't assume that, because Tom didn't.
Tom didn't?
Not at all.
There's no Ariana Grande.
But rest assured, listeners, I now do know who Ariana Grande is and am equipped to talk about at least this one.
All right. Well, maybe I should assign to you the job of quickly explaining.
Oh,
who,
no. That's, no.
Well, okay.
That's a misplacement.
She's a diminutive pop star, little singer with a big voice. She has had lots of pop hits, but here in this summer, she's in the process of releasing a new album. And one of the songs on that album, which has a video that accompanies it, introduces the not particularly new or novel idea that God is a woman. I mean, the notion of God having feminine qualities, God being referred to by a female pronoun is, it's not terra incognita. It might be terra incognita in the world of the top 40 or the Billboard Hot 100. There's some other things to say about this, and particularly because it's also apparently terra incognita in the area around Wind Gap, Missouri, and other places like that, where people think God is masculine and end of story. So first of all, let's hear a little Ariana Grande, if we could.
You love how I move you. You love how I touch you, my one. When all is said and done, you will believe God is a woman. And I feel it after midnight. A feeling that you can't fight, my one. It lingers when we're done. You will believe God is a woman. I don't wanna waste no time, yeah.
keep on flourishing. Yeah. And he's in the universe when I'm the company. Is me. You love her how I move you. You love her how I touch you, my one. When all is said and done, you believe God is a woman. And I feel it after midnight. A feeling that you can't buy, my one. It lingers when we're done. You believe God is a woman.
Okay, so what goes with this is a video. We'll come to the video, and the video has its own set of issues. But the other thing that we have to tell you that is, yes, out in the Bible Belt, wherever that is, this has been upsetting. People who say, I've been tweeting about it, saying, my God is not a woman, sorry to break it to you, but you're not God, and he should never be mentioned in a song about sex. That's just disgusting and disrespectful. So I guess maybe the first thing to say, Mercy, is this is not a theological song about whether or not God is a woman. I mean, Ariana's argument is that you will enjoy your physical encounter with me so much that will cause you to believe that God is a woman.
Which is not atypical of, right, like, people's sort of assessment of their own sexual performance, right? Like, I'm God's gift.
Speak for yourself.
Right? Like the phrase that, oh, my thought would God's be,
you'll believe God is a clown or something.
But I think that, you know, she makes me so uncomfortable because I can't think of her as anything but like a teenager. So this song.
Right. We should say she was introduced to the world. She was like a Nickelodeon star.
Was it Nickelodeon? Disney? Yeah. I think she was a Disney star. Those, and so yeah. I feel really uncomfortable listening to, right like this sort of affirmation of her womanhood. But also, I mean, it's got a kind of catchy beat. And I think that, like, the mention that God should be never discussed in a song about sex is just sort of maybe dismissive of the fact that half of the Bible is about sex one way or another, right? Like, I don't know.
God presumably invented sex along exactly. with everything else.
So it's a little difficult for me to separate the song from the video because this is the first time that I'm listening to just the music independent of the images that go alongside it. And I think that it is a totally familiar, pretty nondescript top 40 pop song, you know, put together by a very competent artist. But I think that combined with, one, the controversy of the Twitter response, but also the images of the video, becomes a much more interesting thing to think about. And I'll give you very quickly my two takeaways from this video and this song is that it's not necessarily provoking me to think that God is a woman, but more in terms of, you know, there's a lot of conversation around non-gender binary pronouns in the culture at large right now. And what I saw in some of the, like, Twitter response to the video of, you know, God is not a man, is not a woman, it's God, but also we refer to God by he. I thought, you know, this is a really provoking me to think about how these, you know, familiar gender pronouns are not applicable to, you know, if you don't think God is dead and if you think God is still out there, then I don't think he or she is either the right way to be talking about this. For the video,
I just want to pause there for a second. You actually extracted a meaningful...
There was a lot. There was a lot there just now. Yeah.
And then I think, you know, I'm glad that you also introduced her as, like, you know, she is known as a diminutive artist. Like, she's a very petite woman, but probably one of the more powerful images in this very, like, zany and strange video for me is of her maybe like 30 foot, you know, feet tall. And then all of these kind of paper cutouts of very angry white men hurling invectives at her. I mean, it's not
phallic images behind
it's
her.
Right. Not a subtle or ambiguous image, but I think it certainly speaks to, you know, a very real phenomenon of, you know, you speak up at all as a woman and be prepared for the horde of men to be throwing vile your way.
I had a friend who, when the movie Ishtar came out, Ishtar was like this famous disaster starring Warren Beatty and Dustin Hoffman at the peak of their careers and directed by Beatty. And she had this really explanation as to why it was a really good movie. And she had extracted content from it that I don't think had been put there. And I said, you should just say that and Warren Beatty will, like, fly you out to L.A., you know, just bring you around to parties with him and stuff like that. And the same thing could happen to you. You did such a good job getting some information.
We haven't even gotten to the screeching groundhogs.
No,
Pedro's probably going to go there.
Yeah, I haven't seen the video, but I just heard the song And I read through the lyrics as I was listening to the song a few times. And, you know, I think it's, it is, it, it, the interesting thing is just that because the title is just God is a Woman and not You'll Believe God is a Woman, it, you know, that's probably 90% of Twitter reaction is simply the title versus anything else. Although, you know, thinking about Ariana Grande and her love life, really, really makes me uncomfortable considering that she's now engaged to Pete Davidson from mm-hmm. Saturday Night Live. And that's just... right? I mean, put this song, watch Pete Davidson for 5 minutes, and then just spend the rest of the afternoon just untwisting what you have just seen, because it's that's just crazy.
I'm going to let you finish, but Beyonce had the best... because Beyonce didn't come under as much fire as Ariana Grande is now. But back when Lemonade came out, mm-hmm. right, her there was a big thing in one of the mini videos from that entire, what was it, the movie that she put together?
Lemonade.
Lemonade. Mm-hmm. It was called Lemonade, right. And she said, God is a black woman, right? She didn't come under nearly as much fire as Ariana Grande did.
I think Beyonce is a really good comparison point for this, because if stuff like Demolition and Lemonade and even the Girls We Run the World video,
yeah.
you know, she is no stranger to feminist mm-hmm. Music videos. But those are actual movies. I mean, they really have like a filmic sensibility yeah. to them. This feels like an internet meme piled on top of an internet meme piled on top. And I don't necessarily mean that in a pejorative way. Like, I found some of the images very silly. I found some kind of powerful, but they all seem to be alluding to some like crazy stuff on the internet that that contributes to whatever toxic masculine culture she may or may not be commenting upon.
It actually might be alluding to something on the internet and this that I don't know about. Like, and throughout watching the entire movie, the video, I'm just like, is there? There's a reference here that I'm not getting, and I'm offended by that.
Well, I think also it makes sense to differentiate between some of the messages cited by Beyonce, who is essentially saying the world would be a better place if people mm-hmm. thought about it this way. Mm-hmm. Whereas Ariana Grande's fundamental argument is, I'm so good in bed that I will actually cause you to adjust your ideas about the deity, which I think is a less constructive message, right? I mean, that is not really a message that's going to help the rest of the world,
right.
you know. Whereas
that's
I think
persuasive.
That is, yeah,
yeah. You know, see, that wasn't my takeway from watching the video. It may be if upon closer inspection,
the video was made by a man named Dave Myers, and I think he took it to another place. He took it to mm-hmm. a place. Let's have an argument about the white patriarchy.
And also, I think just the comfort of showing vaginal imagery in movies. Like, you know, this is something goes back a long time. There are a lot of very strange, like, feminist, separatist art house films from the early 70s that are, like, trying to do somewhat similar stuff. But I give Ariana Grande credit for, like, in the same way that Giorgio, not same artistry, but the same way that Giorgio is throwing, like, you know, vaginas and her stuff and challenging people to like, you know, think about vagina in like represented visually in popular art. I don't know. I think that's kind of cool for a pop star to do.
For me, it was sort of like, okay, we get it. Like all of these images, like all the Yannick images, it was just like every transition was through some sort of like vaginal kind of thing. And it's like, we get it. You God is a woman. Okay, got it. You got it. You sold it.
But still, I think it is unique because it's not the run of the mill happening in every music video, right? So it is kind of a unique take on that. I mean, I think the song is the song, and then they decided to you're like Colin said, make a statement with a video.
Yeah.
I think it was uniquely overdone.
Right.
Well, if you're gonna go there,
right?
Yeah.
I did feel as though yes, Yannick was the word that you used in the in our emails. I felt we went a little further than that. I felt like God was being scoped or something. You know. I thought we had God in the stirrups here.
Dear W,
definitely a trip to the GYN.
So yeah. So anyway, many people were triggered in various ways, and that was the way I was triggered anyway. Like it's Yannick is one thing, Fallopian is like another completely different area. I don't really want to go there. All right, we have to shift gears here to a somewhat more serious situation, which is that, and this has now become sort of, let me kind of describe what I see as the arc of this. Part of the arc of this was that the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement, really did call people on the carpet a little bit about how they talked about various things in the past, what kind of images that they used. A lot of people have been called to account for their actual behavior, and other people have been called to account for their words. This has been hijacked a little bit by the opposition. It's been hijacked by the right. Increasingly, there are attempts to delve into things that have been said by famous people in the past. So James Gunn, the director of Guardians of the Galaxy, somebody unearthed some very old tweets of his at a time when he was very intentionally on Twitter a provocateur, trying to stir people up in various ways that may seem kind of tasteless. Sarah Silverman, who has basically spent the early part of her career almost entirely devoting herself to stirring people up in very funny ways by bringing up things that people were not entirely comfortable with their own laughter about, also has in the past used Twitter as a place to kind of try out some super transgressive material. That's come bubbling up here. And some of this is just sort of the age that we live in. But I don't know. I mean, I'll throw it out. It's not even clear what the consequences of all this are. Tom, I find it hard to understand how Sarah Silverman can get in trouble for transgressive material. Oh, that's right. Yeah, James Gunn, we should say, got fired off the Guardians of the Galaxy series. So, I mean, there are consequences for him. I don't know what can be done to Sarah Silverman. It's not like she said she was somebody else.
So I think that we need to update that that statement by Faulkner, the past is never dead. It's not even past, by saying the past is never dead. It's not even past. It's on Twitter, right? Because every single thing, especially for anyone looking to create some kind, you know, to test out a joke or to create a facet of their personality for the public, is now, you know, forever memorialized on this platform. And how strange, well, maybe we'll get to in a second, how it's not strange. It seems to be a very calculated ploy by the alt-right to do what Mark Harris from Vulture says, which is to get us to think that the tasteless and the racist and hateful are in fact the same. I think that what people like the alt-right blogger Mike Cernovich in attacking James Gunn has done, and the same folks who attack Sarah Silverman, are winning that battle right now in identifying bad jokes about pedophilia that are not, I mean, yes, any joke about pedophilia is terrible, but particularly graphic or shocking to, I don't know. This seems to fit very well within the style of humor and style of provocateurness of both of these people. But of course, context doesn't matter for the alt-right when attacking people for anything that they say. It's all about decontextualizing nonsense and turning it into something that they identify as hate speech to justify their own hate speech. It is infuriating and so much less serious than whatever Ariana Grande is doing. It drives me nuts because this is...
For me, it's elementary. For me, it's like really elementary that they don't give people credit for the complex human beings that we are. And you attribute this to the slippery slope of free speech or restricting free speech conversation. And it's just like, no, it's not a slippery slope, right? We can be complex individuals who in 2003, right, thought that pedophilia jokes were funny, and now we are a little bit more complex and we've grown in the culture, and things like joking about pedophilia and rape, for instance, are no longer funny because we've developed as a culture.
But even going back, I mean, the thing that drives, I share your just like ludicrousness and the fact that, like, you know, Disney fired him. I was just like, what are you doing? Like, stand up, have a conversation, and defend him to the hilt. This is ridiculous because exactly what you say. We're literally, you know, we're getting down to the pig's level.
Yeah.
And we're basically equivalent. You know, we're basically saying, okay, a bad joke is equivalent to people who say things that actually believe the hate. Right? Mike Cernovich actually believes what he's saying. James Gunn didn't believe what he was saying. And the fact that they're now equal and that, you know, it's kind of like the Roseanne, you know, versus, you know, James Gunn. And now it's sort of like, you know, it's, you know, the right loves to do this. Well, if you take one of ours down, we're going to take one of yours down. And the fact that this is where we are is just awful. I really hope that James Gunn gets rehired, that someone wakes up one day and says, oh, this was ridiculous, and moves on. But for now, it is absolutely infuriating.
And then also with the Roseanne thing, we're comparing something current, something mm-hmm. she said,
yes.
That day, to something he said years ago.
Yes, when he wasn't when, James Gunn.
Exactly, when he was not in the public sphere. And I said this before on the show, that we're trying to decide whether or not to hold Roseanne accountable for the thing. She wants us to hold her. She does not mm-hmm. want to be separated from the person that she's been putting forth. Whereas James Gunn, right, like that is not, it was a joke made based off of, right, something he thought was funny, not something he is.
And this isn't a free speech debate at all.
No.
In my eyes or ears. This is all, I mean, but yes, people can make pedophilia jokes. I think the First Amendment definitely covers one's right to do that.
But this is a debate about
whether it is okay to act in total bad faith in decontextualizing statements from people's careers and then assuming that your hate speech is okay if someone else says something that, again, is in bad taste but not perpetrating anything.
And the bad faith.
Another differentiation I would make here is Roseanne's tweet was about actual real people who are living their lives right now.
Yep.
These tweets from the past are kind of hypothetical, imaginary situations. They may be tasteless. They didn't really apply to any very specific person. And the other thing that I have to say is some of the trouble could have been avoided if a lot of these people right around that time, I should have looked up when the book came out, but the media theorist Clay Shirky, who's written very intelligently about the internet over the years, wrote a book called Here Comes Everybody. And one of the points he makes in this book, which is written quite a few years ago, like probably mm-hmm. around the time these people were tweeting, he says, you're publishing. You're a publisher now. Mm-hmm. If you are on Twitter, you're publishing. Everybody has become a publisher. That's what this is. It's publishing. And I think for a lot of comedians, even unto this day, and I would even put myself in this category sometimes too, we think of Twitter as a place where you can try out material, you know, and there's other people around that you know, and maybe some other people around that you don't know that you wouldn't mind impressing with your ability to write a certain kind of joke. And so certainly back then, they were thinking of this more like a funny little seller club somewhere in mm-hmm. Jersey City or something where you could try out some material before you brought it to a more brightly lit stage. And it's anything but. It is publishing.
It is the stage.
Yeah, it is. And it's publishing. You are publishing something. So whatever permanence and level of self censorship you bring to the act of publishing something that you're doing, you should think about it that way on Twitter. And they just didn't. But I agree with everything that you guys are saying, too, that there's a way in which this was just an attempt to sort of, you know, workshop some transgressive comedy ideas as opposed to present some kind of design for living that involves having sex with children.
Yeah. I think by this token, right, by 2020, every single person will be held accountable for every single thing they've ever tweeted except Donald Trump. Right, like,
yep.
I just feel as though we don't give ourselves enough credit for being able to evolve with the culture.
I do love that you know, the people who doggedly go back and find every old Trump tweet that basically
is
the opposite of what he's currently saying, or saying something just ridiculous, just to remind us the Twitter creature that he is.
I think there should be some new Twitter rules. I think one of them should be like the 5-second rule about food that's dropped on the floor. I think you should have about 5 hours to take a tweet down. before you're held completely accountable. I did a really stupid tweet during the World Cup, which somebody called me on right away, and I thought, that's really dumb. And I tweeted back and said, that was a stupid joke by me. I'm taking it down. And presumably it's cached, you know, in 95 different locations.
Oh, for sure.
And, That would be good. And I also think that maybe we do need a Twitter statute of limitations or something like that, because it is different. Something that you're tweeting today, if you're Roseanne Barr, is kind of different from what you might have understood Twitter to be, 9 years. We're not going to get a statute of limitations, but it might make sense to have one.
I really enjoyed the conversation that you had on this very program on Monday, talking about some political reporters like Maggie Haberman who are temporarily abstaining from tweeting and also reading President Trump's tweets, just because of the inane like inundation of all that stuff. How it's not necessarily news to write about that every single day. But I think I disagree. I think that it's very important to read everything that President Trump tweets, especially if you're writing about it as a national politics reporter, for exactly what you just said, Colin, because these are, you know, published statements by the head of our country. And I don't think that it's unreasonable to look at one of these tweets by Sarah Silverman or James Gunn and say, this is horrible. You know, why? And, you know, not to say, we don't have to look at this because it's so long ago. No, I think it's fine to have a conversation about, but I think it's ridiculous to fire these people from projects within, you know, hours without having, you know, without giving the statute of limitation or without giving that kind of that thinking time to stop.
But back to Pedro's point, it was so easy for Disney just to pull the trigger really fast. You know, I mean, and I'm sure that that's sort of their corporate algorithm right now. Oh, we're getting this kind of pushback, just lose them, you know. We'll just lose them and then we'll figure something out later. We should take a break just so we have time to enter the day drinking capital of America and meet Amy Adams, as blousy and miserable as you will ever see her. So we'll do that. Here we are back in the studios of Gateway Community College. I mean, our studios in Gateway Community College. With me are Tom Breen and Mercy Quay and Pedro Soto. We are talking now about a new release on HBO. I think we're only three episodes deep now into Sharp Objects. Sharp Objects is based on an early novel by Gillian Flynn. It's directed by the director of Big Little Lies and movies like Wild and Dallas Buyers Club. Stars Amy Adams as a reporter, a newspaper reporter who's getting sent back to her hometown where there's been some murders by her boss, Frank Curry, who sort of, if Lou Grant smoked and drank more and was more Southern or something. Anyway, here's the two of them.
Wind Gap. It's a bike.
Okay, well, it's at the bottom of Missouri. Boot Hill, spitting distance from Tennessee.
I know where it is. I asked what it's like.
Small. Population's held at 2,000 for years. Only real industry is hog butchering, so you got your old money and your trash.
Mm-hmm. Which one are you?
Trash. From old money.
What the hell's going on?
In Wind Gap, or?
Your mom's still there, right, Preeka?
Mom? Stepdad, they had a kid. Have, I don't really know her.
But you talked to them?
Not if I can help it.
Well, read the wires then. Jesus Christ, there was a murder there last August. Little girl got strangled.
Well, I didn't know.
Well, then you also don't know that another one's missing now. Might be a serial. So get your ass down to that heel or whatever and get me a story now, today.
We have murders here, Curry, so I don't see why I gotta go to Wind Gap.
Because nobody else is covering it. Do you remember that piece in the Tribune last year? A guy who wrote about a killing in his hometown? It made an impact because it was personal. People give a when you give a
I'm not gonna win a Pulitzer off of Wind Gap.
You're not winning a Pulitzer because you're only half good at writing. This could change that. And I'm your boss. So goodbye.
So goodbye. And so Amy Adams, or Camille Preeker, as she's known in this series, heads back down, smoking cigarettes the entire way and doing this odd thing where she transfers vodka into an Evian water bottle and then drinks out of the Evian water bottle, apparently. She's certainly not fooling us. We're watching the whole thing. Maybe she fools somebody
she
that
fooling?
Way. Who could? Yeah. Who knows? She may fool a lot of people, although we're told that it could be still smelled upon her. So, Mercy, as my tone suggests, I was less than happy with this.
Yeah.
But I'm really happy to find out that
I loved it.
That you liked it. So get us started here.
Okay. So let me explain. Part of the reason why I loved it is because I feel like it captures that feeling of a reporter covering things in their hometown, which I relate to. Right. When I first started reporting, I was up in Torrington, but then I was moved down to the New Haven Register to cover breaking news. And breaking news is horrible, right? You're covering, and especially here in New Haven during the summer, you're covering murders, you're covering fires, triple fate of fires and things like that. And so for me, it was just, they got it so right, the just awkwardness and the feeling of this should be fine for me to talk to you, but I also know that it's not because I know so much about your family. And I loved being able to relate to that character. But right before we went on air, we were talking about the genre of YouTubing where everyone whispers into the microphone. And I kind of feel that way about this show where Amy Adams, that's who this is, right? She's yes. speaking so lowly that like I am partially glued to the seat and leaning in
just to hear
her like and maybe that's a tactic, maybe that's like an acting tactic, I don't know what it is, but I was glued to the seat for that and for just the storyline itself.
One thing, Tom, that is going on here also, this director in this particular environment, I would describe his technique as, did I actually just see that? Because there's just this constant sort of flashing of imagery, some of which is from the past, some of which is from the present, some of which is from the imagination. And there's not very many good sorting mechanisms. I find that very disorienting.
Yeah. So I think that a good word, and I like this series, but I think a good word to describe my experience with it is exhausting. And I think that it, on the positive side, I love what you just said about how this captures the discomfort and fatigue of being a reporter back in your hometown. Because even though I didn't grow up in New Haven, I've been here for 8 years and reporting on a daily basis. I think this movie or this show really captures how, one, how difficult it is to keep your own personal stuff out of your work when everyone that you're working with knows your personal stuff too.
Yeah.
How difficult that is. But also how you always, you know, if All the President's Men shows reporters, you know, pushing the limits of strangers because they see a really important story. Here we have her knowing that she has to be a little bit ingratiated. She has to stay on the right side of the right people because it's not just that they are a source of good information, but they also share a town with her. But in terms of fatigue, I think that the style that is of just the constant flashbacks of never really knowing whether you have your foot is in the past or in the present, I think the good parts of that are kind of an homage to the directing style of David Fincher, who adapted Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, I think very successfully a couple years ago, in its what are called jump cuts, where you're comfortable in a spot, and then all of a sudden the camera takes you immediately to a different area where people are in a similar position, but you're in a completely different setting. It's disorienting. It's kind of an exciting feeling, but it is also a disorienting one. But those spatial jumps with the time jumps, I think that it's a bit much for Jean-Marc Vallée to stay on top of for most of the series. Fortunately, the series, I think, has a lot of really strong horror elements going for it that maybe I'll get back to you in a second.
Right. Can I just say, I don't think that would work, that style, that those jump cuts wouldn't work for a film. Because, I mean, even Colin, you said this last night. I found myself rewinding it every single time I blinked too much, right? If I sneezed and I missed a couple. There's so much context that you lose if you're not paying attention.
I was actually falling asleep, so there's a little bit different. So I would have to rewind as well. I also want to say, nuts in Charlotte's Web, have we relied so much on imagery of spiders and pigs? if you have to choose one of the two, I would still say go with Charlotte's Web. But Pedro, we should say that the family of Camille, aka Amy Adams, does own a big pig farm, big pig processing thing, and one of the murdered girls is very fond of spiders. So, E.B. White, eat your heart out, I guess. But Pedro, you're a little bit more getting started. You're not quite as deep into the hot, sultry miasma of sharp objects. But I gather you're with it so far.
Yeah, based on the first episode. I think it's, you know, it definitely has that HBO ridiculously high production value to it. I mean, it's just amazing kind of, you know, the toys that everyone gets to play with these days, I think. It's done great. I think Amy Adams as a grizzled smoking alcoholic, I'm still being like, oh, it could have. I mean, I think that the choice of actor, I think she's a fantastic actress. I think she's great. But her in this, I'm still getting used to that because it still feels like, you know, Amy Adams playing the character rather than someone who, you know, there could have been a few other, you know, actresses who I think could have sort of gotten into the role, you know, a lot, look the part, act the part a little better.
It's sort of like a Jessica Jones. Who's that actor from Jessica Jones?
Oh, I can't think of what her name
is. Oh, yeah. So,
I was
thinking, she would have been great. Right. Yeah, that exactly, exactly.
I was thinking as you were talking, Elizabeth Taylor waited a lot longer to do Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. You
know? Exactly.
I Pedro, I think I wonder how you'll if you stick with it, how you'll respond to that character two episodes in, because I think that my problem with her the first episode, I thought, you know, here she's constantly drinking and driving, constantly smoking, constantly just abusing herself, and we see almost none of that in her, like Amy Adams, like very well put together and still like, you know, very beautiful and like luscious, you know, red hair and stuff. But then as the show progresses, we see how she very deliberately hides the toll that this is taking on her body. Sometimes it's to, like, you know, garish extremes that we see how that toll is taken, but I think that Amy Adams manages to show how, you know, she's wearing like long sleeves, not just literally, but everywhere around her body, because if she shows, like, the one thing she has going for her is that not everyone knows how bad it is for her.
Right.
So speaking, as Tom was, about the horror elements of this, we'll play another clip here. This is Chris Messina as Detective Richard Willis and Matt Craven as the police chief, Bill Vickery. Chris Messina plays this kind of hotshot who has been sent down there under some kind of send a hotshot program that the police have
straighten this out.
From Kansas City.
Yeah, Kansas City hotshot.
And Chris Messina is struggling because he's the only person who in town who is not constantly drinking and smoking. The police chief smokes so much that she actually becomes somewhat uncomfortable with it. Anyway, here they are trying to figure out what's going on.
Warden.
Kansas City.
You know, I've been thinking.
Uh-oh.
Why does a killer change his MO like that? First body, left at the kill site in the forest. But Natalie, she's dumped in the middle of town like a prop or a doll.
My daughter had one of them dolls. A little for her mouth. Creepy little things.
Getting her there was risky. Way more chance of getting caught.
You know, some killers want to get caught. Cry for help.
This one likes making people scared for their girls.
Can we just save the Silence of the Land routine for another time?
Look, Bill, I get it, okay? This is your home. You gotta look out for your people. But odds are the killer's gonna show up here, soak up the atmosphere.
I read them books too, Agent Starling. Watch out for anyone trying to insert himself into the action, anyone trying too hard with the family.
The nature of this crime, it's personal. This guy wants to rule the town.
Well, he may not rule it, but he sure as hell got our attention.
This, you know, Pedro, this is sort of the problem with everything these days, which is that, you know, all the characters on The Sopranos have seen all of the Scorsese movies.
Right.
And it turns out all of the cops, you know, they've all read those Thomas Harris books.
Exactly. It's all very, you know, I think anyone writing these days has to be self-referential, or else you're like, wait, don't they know with how this stuff works? So they have to all call it out.
It's kind of like how in The Walking Dead, no one's in this is a world where zombie movies don't exist.
Don't exist. Exactly.
So Tom, you talked about horror. And as things go along here, I'll just sort of let you pick it up.
I'll use Pedro's comment as a quick transition, because I think that that type of referencing other familiar material is not necessarily a bad thing. I think kind of what genre, you know, filmmaking or fiction writing is. You kind of have a structure that most people are aware of, and then you tinker with the different elements for delightful and, like, surprising results. So this show is produced by Blumhouse Productions, which has become a very big and very successful kind of an oxymoron, but a low-budget horror filmmaking production company. Get Out, they produce, probably their best known, but they also have done the past few M. Night Shyamalan movies, including The Visit, and also the Schizophrenic. And also a movie called Insidious. And I think that what Get Out and this show do very well is what someone like David Lynch also did really well, which is, you know, look at this potentially kind of picturesque small town America, and then dig an inch deep, and you realize that this is a really nasty and vile and really dangerous place for the people who live there and for anyone visiting. I think that without revealing too much about the kind of spectral presence that makes itself felt halfway through the show, Blumhouse Productions knows that you don't have to have something flash in front of a screen in order to really scare the audience. It doesn't even have to be close to the camera. The scariest moment in the show for me happens about 50 feet away from where Amy Adams' character is watching. Someone just kind of comes out of the woods, goes back in, and that image has stuck with me since I watched the show. So I give them a lot of credit for creating the atmosphere of dread, for relying on those jump cuts to disorient, but really for like taking some space and distance and letting like spooky stuff really stick with the audience as opposed to people with knives running around.
By the way, the name we were looking for was Kristen Ritter.
Yeah, her. I think she would have been great for this.
I have a plan. And we can start working on this just, this afternoon when we're done here, which is that, so Amy Adams has already said she doesn't want there to be a season two of this because she does not want to play that person again. It's not fun playing this miserable, unhappy, drunken, chain-smoking person. And just, she's at the end of every day, she feels like she's just crying because she's doing her job well and she doesn't want to do that again. So, we'd have to maybe do like a one episode arc where that character is killed off. And then Jessica Jones comes down to Wingow.
It's a crossover episode. Speaking of crossover episode, I think it's episode 3 where Amy Adams' character checks into a suicide watch clinic, right? And her roommate is, if anyone's caught up on Handmaid's Tale, yeah, her roommate is she's the actor that plays the new wife, the driver's new wife in the second season of The Handmaid's Tale. And for me, I was just like, ooh, okay, Mercy. Well, this is how this works. This was a pre-Gilead series. I won't cause any spoilers. So that was also disorienting for me because I just feel as though it was so. That character, that actress was so, she played that character so similarly to how she played her character in Gilead.
Maybe we're just watching one show, like all the shows that we're watching now, they're just one show.
Wait, Colin, you said you were really into Patricia Clarkson as Blanche DuBois as whatever the name of the mother is.
Yes. Adora?
Adora.
So
Adora.
What'd you like about Adora?
Well, first of all, I'm doubting that I will continue with this series, but maybe I will. I don't know. You're sort of selling it back to me, but the Patricia Clarkson, first of all, is just worth watching doing pretty much anything. And so in this, she plays the mother of Amy Adams. She is someone who's herself damaged in odd ways, but ways that make her meddlesome. But she's also in this kind of permanent Tennessee Williams doll-like state where when she dresses up for a funeral, she dresses up like a little girl. She wears a little black bow in her hair or something like that. So I don't know the part, the way it's written doesn't really make any sense to me. I don't understand what it is she's looking for or why she's doing most of the things that she's doing. Maybe that will be explained ultimately. But occasionally, partly also because this is, to use the words of our president and the perceptions that you guys have shared, low energy, right? And Patricia Clarkson every once in a while will jolt this thing because she just has a different plan from everybody else. And she's got a little bit of pep when she does it. All right, we're going to have to stop there just so we have time to make some recommendations. Whether or not this was a recommendation or not, you can decide for yourself. It's atmospheric. It's got a lot of big names attached to it. Give it a try if you want to. And Mercy and Pedro, I say, go ahead.
Love is a burning thing, and it makes a fiery ring. Bound by wild desire, I fell into your ring of fire.
Today's show was produced by Jonathan McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Patricia Clarkson. On Monday's show, we'll be back with news from over the weekend on The Scramble. And now, back to Colin.
And I'm back here in New Haven with Tom Breen, Mercy Quay, Pedro Soto. We're going to make some recommendations for you, to you. Tom, why don't you start us off?
Sure. So I guess I'll recommend two movies that I actually reviewed with my fellow reporter at The Independent, Alan Appel, on the most recent episode of Deep Focus. So a plug there. But the first is called Leave No Trace. which is a new movie from director Deborah Granik, who made Winter's Bone about a decade ago, which was Jennifer Lawrence, she of Hunger Games and now Everything fame. But that was her breakthrough role as a young woman trying to solve a crime somewhere in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas. This feels very similar, except set on the opposite end of the country. This is in Portland, Oregon. A father, played by Ben Foster, an ex-Marine suffering from PTSD, and his teenage daughter, Thomasine McKenzie, are living off the grid in Forest Park in the middle of Portland, trying to remove themselves as much as possible from society they feel they have no truck with. The movie, I think to its credit, does not follow a predictable line of they're living off the grid, they're found, they're forced to adapt. No, these are migratory people. I mean, they do not go down without a fight, and I think that the distinction between the daughter and the father in this movie is a really powerful one to depict in terms of all these movies getting at kind of an American isolation vigilante, this whole you do it yourself. This is a great take on it. So Leave No Trace is my movie recommendation.
All right. Peter, what have you got for us?
Tomorrow night in New Haven, on the green, Taylor Dane. So from the 80s, but she is playing on the green, and actually I'm unreasonably excited for it. But in general, the New Haven concert series on the green are always a lot of fun, always worth coming in. And, you know, usually my recommendations are something New Haven related. So this is yet another one. Come down for one of the great many restaurants that we have here and bring a blanket or some chairs and come out for a free concert of some 1980s nostalgia. And
I'm trying to remember what Taylor Dane's big hit is. Not
I'll Always Love You. Uh-huh. Prove Your Love.
All right.
I could sing them if you want.
All right. Maybe good. that'll be a web extra.
Yeah.
All right. Mercy, what have you got for us?
Keeping true to the pattern that I've recently developed of recommending space-related endorsements. And if at this moment you're wondering how can she possibly have more space-related endorsements?
We're out of space.
You are not giving the observable universe enough credit. So a movie on Netflix, it's called Europa Report. It is about the planet's first manned mission to another planet, world, which is Europa. Forgive for the moment that it is ridiculous that the first manned mission to another world would be to Jupiter's moon as opposed to Mars. Forgive that for a moment. It is a great movie filled with suspense and an alien type that you haven't seen before. Additionally, the Planetary Society, headed up by Bill Nye, who's like the CEO of the Planetary Society, they are planning a space-themed cruise for next year. But in order to get that off the ground, they need folks to fill out a survey about what they want to see on the space-themed cruise. Neil deGrasse Tyson will also be there. So what I need so that I can attend this cruise is all of you to take that survey so that they can get this off the ground. You can find the survey on the on the Planetary Society's Instagram page. Thank you.
All right. I can't imagine a cruise I less want to go on. Except possibly this sharp objects themed cruise. That would be a terrible
that
cruise.
That would be awful. Right. So, everyone has to wear long sleeves.
I mentioned that I took the train down here to New Haven, which I've been doing to do this show. When we do it, I got off and I walked down Crown Street and I stopped in at Meat and Company. Meat as in the opposite of vegetables. And a delicious sandwich is a really wonderful place. And despite the name, they have all vegetable sandwiches there if that's what you want to do. And they use a lot of local ingredients and will offer you, for example, today, some Swiss chard relish where they grew the Swiss chard, you know, just a few feet away from where you're eating. So that's just terrific. I also want to, this is a little complicated, you know, looking at Amy Adams playing this horribly damaged person, I was thinking about another performance that's been going on cable television for many years now, and that is Claire Danes as Carrie Matheson on Homeland. I just watched the seventh and most recent, I think it's the seventh, the most recent series of Homeland, which has really written as close to today's news as they can possibly get it.
Yep.
And it has some really remarkable things. Did you get all the way to the end
I'm
of it?
All done.
The speech that's given at the end of it is a speech that we all need to hear. And I think this performance that Claire Danes is giving, which is frequently over the top and can be grating at times, still is asking a really interesting question, a different one from the vodka in the Evian bottles. She plays somebody with severe bipolar disorder, and there's a question about whether the medication that fixes her makes her less effective in certain ways at intuiting out certain things that she's really good at. And so this is it takes, you know, a fairly serious look at the whole question of mental illness and access to medication, and a very serious look at the state of our democracy right now. And you could probably watch this last season without having watched all the other ones too. So I'm going to recommend that. I should also mention that our producer Jonathan McPants co-endorsed the Europa Project.
So Europa Report.
Europa Report. Sorry. So thanks to Tom and to Mercy and Pedro. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Jonathan for engineering. We'll be back on Monday.